Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network, New Books in History. I'm your host, R. Grant Kleiser. With me today is Dr. Anne Goldman. Dr. Goldman is a professor of English at Sonoma State University and author of Take My Word, Autobiographical Innovations of Ethnic American Working Women, Continental Divides, Revisioning American Literature, and Maria Amparo Ruiz de Burton, Critical and Pedagogical Perspectives. She has published essays and fiction pieces in many journals, while being nominated for a National Magazine Award and recognized with the National Endowment for the Humanities Award, as well as an Mason Getty Fellowship. Today, I have the pleasure to talk with her about her new book entitled Stargazing in the Atomic Age, which has already been awarded a Kirkus Star Review. Part intellectual history, part personal narrative, this book demonstrates how Jewish scientists, musicians, writers, and artists were able to create beauty and tremendous achievement during the 20th century, a time we often associate with purely affliction and horror for the Jewish people. Dr. Goldman charts the verve, energy, and unyielding spirit of people like Einstein, George Gershwin, Marc Chagall, and Saul Bellow, as they, in her words, quote, turn the awful into awe through their scientific and artistic contributions in this era. Dr. Goldman, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast, and congratulations on your new work.
Thank you, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Our pleasure. So to start off the conversation, I'd like to first talk to you about what inspired you to write this piece. Why this book, and why now?
Well, if I were going to be flippant, and I would say that I have always had a tendency toward contention or pushing against established wisdom. And I think I see my father as the driver for that characteristic in my own nature, and also as a driver for this book. So, you know, Jewish history writ large is almost always framed as a series of calamities. And while that is undeniably true, what that narrative leaves out is that in between catastrophes, there are periods of great achievement. There are periods of peace. I think what I would also say is that I'm probably pushing against notions of history that foreground or that define the word historical event synonymous with conflict and war. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to think about material history, daily life, and the life of the mind. And the life of the mind happens whether there are, God forbid, bombs exploding nearby, or whether life is bucolic and peaceful. So that's what I was really struck by, was the fact that thinking about Jewish life need not only be thinking about melancholy and about affliction, that in fact there's tremendous energy. I mean, I think this is true of all peoples. And I wanted to look very clearly and specifically at the extraordinary efforts of mine that produced stunning work across the arts and sciences. And then, and because I was developing this argument, I really wanted to locate it squarely in the middle part of the 20th century. I think also, thinking about our own day, it's a way of maintaining hope, of maintaining perspective, and of reminding me that, and readers, that even when things look very difficult, that we are always, we carry on, and we are doing remarkable things.
That's certainly an important point to talk about in this new year of 2021, and something that I think the book says loud and clear as a message of hope. So that's great. Going off of that sort of the intellectual journey that you were briefly referencing, if I'm correct, I believe that your titular essay or chapter, Stargazing in the Atomic Age, which discusses the scientists behind the Manhattan Project, was first written or first conceived in 2006 or thereabouts, and that other essays and chapters were also first composed over a decade ago. So, you know, when did you first think that these essays, these ideas would become a book, and how have they changed over time as you've been thinking about them?
So I thought of them as a collection fairly early on. I don't know that I realized I was writing what feels like the kind of overture of the book, if you will, in the titular essay, and that really is what it became. And when I look back at the essays, I see that what I tried to do, as well as foreground innovation in science, and to yoke, I guess one of the things that I was interested in doing was, again, to sort of push against these conventional notions of Jewish life. So I thought I would take the Holocaust, which feels like a black hole for all of us, sort of sucking in all kinds of life and energy and not leaving anything. And then to think about that strange fact that while Jews were central as victims of the Holocaust, they were also central as scientists in the development of the bomb at the same time. And that seemed an interesting juxtaposition for me to think about. So that kept me going for quite a while. But I did, I write slowly. I read, I take writing essays as an excuse to learn. So I just thought I would like to work across fields. And so I just sort of set about in my turtle way to look at painting, to look at physics, eventually to look at math. That's the latest essay, and that was actually written quite recently, to look at literature, my own field. But all of that took a great deal of time, and I really, many of these essays I spent months reading for, because I was trespassing on other people's terrain, and I felt that I should have at least some sort of basic sense of the field before I, in my typical brash way, began to write about them.
Of course. So speaking of those subjects and those people you chose, in your introduction, you stated that as you cast about for illustrations of a particularly Jewish accomplishment in this era, the challenge was not to locate, but to limit the number. So how did you actually make these choices for whom and what to write about?
So in a way, they didn't even seem like choices to me. I mean, what ended up happening was that I would read about people, or I would think about particular innovators or artists that who somehow felt already familiar to me. So for instance, Saul Bellow, I really only had to read, one novel to realize, here are characters. So in Augie March, for instance, here are characters who feel like the kinds of people I grew up with. And And this is where I should say that one of the primary drivers for the book, although I didn't quite see how that worked at the time, was my own father, who died actually in 12 years now, but who was absolutely full of life until the day he died, and constantly working. He was a pulmonary physiologist, a scientist, and a physician, and he was constantly working on new ideas. So it was also very difficult to live with, eccentric, and quick to anger, quick to forgive. I think I was less so in the latter when I was a child. I was pretty stubborn. But that personality, that kind of magnetism and charisma, but also a kind of a never give up energy, is what was extremely familiar to me growing up. And that is really what I saw mirrored, I felt, in the people whose work I ended up exploring. So there really was, in some sense, I suppose, there was that sort of family kind of experience that undergirded everything. But I think all of us as readers of fiction probably have a sense sometimes in authors we love, and I'd be curious to sort of get your sense of this, Grant, but are there people you read who you think, I know this person, I know this writer better than other people, and I want to take ownership? I don't know if you've had that experience. I imagine you probably have. And that is really the people I ended up writing about. I felt that way about all of them. And of course, I don't own them. That's just the kind of yearning that one has, when you feel like you've connected deeply with something, to feel that the person is speaking only to you. Yeah, but definitely. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, in my discipline, history, we're constantly encouraged to read into at least the intellectual background of the authors we're reading, because it's often hard to fully understand their works if we don't understand, where they're coming from, especially intellectually, who their advisors were, what influence they had on their lives, but also their personal lives too. And so I can definitely, see myself in certain authors or see, resonances to people in my life, in certain authors and their experiences, definitely in my experience. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things that, that biography can do, is to provide us the sort of a glimpse, of course, curated. And that's why it can be helpful to read, for me, I prefer, reading a few biographies, so that I really get a sense of, what are the cross currents and what are the patterns. But I really do then feel like I'm kind of stepping into this person's world. And as you say, really, the more data you have, the better.
Definitely, definitely. So you just mentioned your father's influence on this book, and it's someone who in the book you say is, quote, chronically hostile to despair, and so very much comes across and has resonances with a lot of the characters you show. But I was wondering too, if you could talk a little bit about your mother's influence on this book as well, whom you dedicate the book to, and who appears at the very end of the book.
Yeah, so my mother, it was always the voice of calm and the voice I was going to say the voice of reason. I think she has a way of speaking that reminds me of the way hummingbirds dart and flit. So again, growing up, there weren't those long sustained whole notes to borrow from music as a metaphor. We always had grace notes and trills sort of flourishing cadenzas. That was the way we lived. But that said, my mother was a tempering influence. And one of the things I think that has stayed with me, my dad did not suffer fools gladly. And I think, unfortunately, that can be my tendency too. I'm not a poker face. And so people see when I get impatient, and like my father, I get impatient a lot, but my mother is far more patient. She's a very forgiving person. And I can remember her telling me when I was young, that that we need to think that there are other gifts besides, intellection. And, as I grew older, I realized that there are different ways to think about intellection. And that we need to think about ethics, in relation, not just to aesthetics, but to science and the ways that those, are yoked. And that is something that I was interested in doing in this book.
Yeah. Yeah. And just kind of speaking on that, and what you're talking about, that the sort of personal experiences and how many times throughout the book, you interweave this intellectual history with those personal experiences, with your own life, your own reflections on your father and eventually your mother. And I have a sort of a bigger question or idea here, and, you know, commenting on how this is such a unique work in terms of genre in this blending of intellectual history and personal narrative essays. And first, you know, what inspired you to create this blending, this interweaving of genres for this book in particular?
You know, it's such an excellent question. And if I think about walking around it, and my first response would be to say, you know, I'm not quite sure. I just know that from the get-go, when I began writing essays that I distinguished as creative from those scholarly pieces that I have written, and to a certain extent still continue to write. Although I can say that I've kind of gone over to the dark side and mostly just write creative work at this point. But this is just how I began writing, by yoking my own understanding with that of other people. I think from the beginning, I had the sense of kind of reaching across, which is what any writer is doing. That sense of that when you write, creation is about expression and communication as well. And so perhaps that is one facet of the sort of genesis of this particular kind of hybrid form that I'm writing within, is that in foregrounding or keeping myself in mind, that close connection I had with the people I was writing about, was easier to sustain. I mean, I think part of it too is, that it felt right, in the sense of, understanding that however one collects data, you know, I'm the one collecting it, and that there is no truly objective locale. And I mean, I think even, you know, one of the things that strikes me about science is so fascinating is, of course, that's, you know, what one works toward, presumably, is sort of double blind experiments. But it's always fascinating to hear people speak with conviction about particular theories and then to see them overturned. And we've seen that, as you well know, better than me. And if it, you know, yeah, I'm sure you could come up with a whole list in the 18th century of notions that have been overturned, and notions that were framed with confidence. So I think that sense of part of it is a little bit about humility and thinking, yes, we can look out at the galaxy, we can look out at the stars, but we do need to remember that we're looking at the stars from a particular location in a little solar system that is not front and central.
Yeah, that's definitely something I didn't even really think about, but it's so true in that, you know, especially as academics, we are always taught to try to be objective and to come up with the sort of objective truth. But at the end of the day, we are also conditioned to defend our theories and defend our version of the truth as well. So having that perspective, you know, that being very obvious of that, your own personal perspective, really is a form of humility or a true honesty, I think. And I just had a quick comment, because this kind of reminded me of a assignment that I had to do as an undergraduate for a history class. And this is a shout out to my history professor, Yvonne Fabella, for assigning this piece. And what we had to do for our final project was to write a historical fiction essay or chapter, short story, but footnote and reference certain historical works that I had read over the semester. So this is a class on the colonial Caribbean. So my historical fiction piece was writing from a first-person perspective on a Maroon, is a escaped slave who was fighting in the Haitian Revolution in the late 18th century. And so every time I sort of referenced his tactics and his experience, I would put in footnotes for that. And I just thought it was a kind of relevant to your piece, but just a really good exercise of trying to expose and trying to convey truth in a way that was very engaging and personal and creative. So I thought that was, you know, a relevant and worthwhile project that isn't often done, I think, in any of this, because of sort of the conformities of different genres in the world today.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a wonderful assignment, and how gracious of you to shout out to your mentor. I think there is something to be said for, I mean, this is sort of contested terrain these days, you know, what is empathy, of what does empathy consist? It does seem to me that being able to imagine another's life is crucial if we're going to sustain care for others. And of course, you know, that's something that I think we all do want to do. We sometimes, when we get upset, when we feel offended, we sort of close up, seal up the self, and shore up the boundaries of the self. But if we keep them open, we're more likely to feel, you know, we're more likely to be less corroded. So I think there's that kind of self-interest, but there is also just the genuine sort of glory of imagining what life is like for someone else. And that's a glory, even if that person's life is, if we see it as very tragic, because there is, again, something, that ability to try to understand and to try to imagine, seems to me, it's the trying that's important. And, you know, I think that, you know, your teacher's sense that go back and call yourself to account and then come up with the references is really, really astute, because that way, you know, we zigzag back and forth. Yes. To realize, well, we are not that person. We can imagine only so far, but again, that sort of dancing back and forth across perspective seems to me really crucial, and something we probably should maintain, you know, most of the time, even though it can feel difficult. But I think it's a really worthy effort.
Yeah, and on that point, did you, you know, English, of course, is a different discipline from history and others. So perhaps it's you didn't experience this as much, but did you ever feel any pushback to this hybrid genre form from fellow academics or other presses, or any, you know, challenges that you faced when performing this work?
Well, I probably would have if I had read this work only or projected only for a scholarly audience. But from the beginning, I really did, I think, want to write for you know, Virginia Woolf sort of says it's a common reader, and, you know, people have lambasted her and reproached her for that, because of course, you know, what was her understanding of common? And that word has so many connotations, many of them very derogatory. But I guess I would say that, you know, the reader who's interested, who's curious, who wants to read around and travel from discipline to discipline. So I actually was very fortunate in that that first piece that I wrote, I sent to the Georgia Review, and the former editor, Stephen Corey, who I cannot thank enough for, you know, he's really the person who brought this book into being as a book, because he invited me to turn in the manuscript and to think about it as a volume. He accepted it for the Georgia Review, and that was my first creative publication. So it was a wonderful, wonderful way to start. So from the beginning, I think, but that said, of course, the Georgia Review is housed at the University of Georgia, as are so many, you know, journals of creative writing, quarterlies. So, so in a sense, there's, you know, there's always been that sort of dual audience. And I very much hope that I can write across. And I feel, yeah, in terms of the people I've spoken with, I did check with scholarly readers and experts in the various disciplines, all of these pieces, because I wanted to have to make sure that I wasn't making some sort of gross overgeneralizations or really, really stumbling. Mm-hmm. And I found that the specific people I spoke with were extraordinarily open and interested. So, I mean, I'll have to see what the Academy writ large thinks, but I think things have begun to change in that, you know, there are a number of people who have started to experiment in a limited way with foregrounding the self in scholarship. You know, there's still probably few and far between, but I think that for the most part, there is genuine interest and acceptance.
Yeah. Fantastic. So moving on, just to give our listeners a little taste of the content of this book here, I was wondering if you could talk about a couple of the examples from the essays you read about and the characters in your story of people who refused to give in to despair and led to such tremendous achievement. So first, can you talk just a little bit about Einstein's love of chamber music and his inspiration that he derived from Mozart?
Yeah, so Einstein, like many of the figures in the book, was really, I think his life was sustained by music. And for Einstein in particular, Mozart, although I should say that also, you know, Saul Bellow gave a speech about Mozart that turned into a published piece. And Mark Rothko painted pretty much only to Mozart, sometimes opera, sometimes other work. What I wanted to do was to think about how someone who thinks creatively to solve problems, you know, what their life would be like. And in Einstein, I really felt that the relationship between music and physics that he saw and this is in the lay literature that I've read, I could not, there's no way that I could explore anything with an equation in it that is even a quadratic equation at this point is probably beyond me. That he really understood his life in terms of music as well as physics. And I mean, if we think about earlier writers, that sense of harmony, of balance, of interval, there are ways that music has of explaining the world, and perhaps they are not so far away from the ways that that scientists in general and Einstein in particular have of thinking about scientific problems. I think also, it's that feeling life. Music is really the language of feeling, and we've all, I think, probably listened to things whose words we don't know or that are wordless and felt that they communicated to us in very specific and distinct ways. And I think that's what Einstein drew for music, especially because he was stateless for so long, bounced around from place to place, and knew that he would not really be returning home when he came to the United States. So, you know, you to think about spending your day communicating in a different language and ultimately probably thinking and dreaming in it is a way to shut off part of the earlier self. And I think that that music must have provided him, you know, with that right of return that he was denied, you know, by the government, and that listening to Mozart in particular, most likely, would have been a balm and a solace and a way of returning.
Yeah, this is very anecdotal and probably not relevant, but my parents were also convinced that Mozart was good for the intellect. And so every morning before a major standardized test in middle school and high school, they'd always play Mozart for me while I was eating breakfast. So,
oh, that's so marvelous. That's such a great anecdote. I've got to remember to tell that to my daughter. Who's sort of my editor and writing partner. I think it is relevant. I mean, in the sense of, you know, listening to music requires, from my, again, very limited understanding, many areas of the brain fire at once. So it seems like the perfect exercise if one has to then go in and concentrate on an exam, which requires a great deal of intellectual strength. There's something about, I think Mozart, you know, he's such a feeling composer. He's so, there's such a range of feeling in his music, and it's always tempered by that 18th century notions of balance and harmony. So it's so confirming, I think, to feel that you know, that a composer explores so many states of feeling. But then there is resolution, and there is at the same time these gorgeous harmonies that suggest that all is right with the world, you know, even if that's not the case, but for moments.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking of music, and just since we're on that topic, could you talk a little bit about Gershwin, about your composer George Gershwin, and his pace and vitality of the music, which you say is, quote, too quizzical for artlessness and too charming for melancholy. So how is he able to, you know, resist this prominent war-weary modernism and cynicism that you talk about that was, you know, so prevalent at his time?
I think Gershwin just was born with a phenomenal amount of energy and exuberance and arrogance, if you will. But he was phenomenally gifted. And so like Mozart, who and in that chapter two on Gershwin, I set up three short lives, Gershwin's, Mozart's, and then my brother David's, because he passed away from lung cancer at 31 and had about, you know, 9 months to sort of realize that he was very ill. Gershwin became famous at a very young age, like Mozart. I think he knew that he was very gifted, and that would have been a spur. He was the child of immigrants. And that is something else that I really wanted to explore in the book as a whole, was the contributions of immigrants to U.S. life. Mm-hmm. And Gershwin had that volatile, but I think exuberant mix of accents and languages growing up. His parents spoke in very thickly accented English. And so for a musician, you know, sort of catch these range of tonalities, first of all, as a child, presumably that's what we hear, is the tones. Even before we understand the language that our parents and the people we hear use, we hear tones and inflections. And so Gershwin would have heard a great many. So I think from the get-go, he was used to sort of balancing all that. I mean, I think he was just unstoppable. He just was, you know, it seems that every reminiscence and recollection I read about Gershwin commented on that fact, that he just was extraordinarily affirmative champagne, you know, all of the time. That that said, you know, one of the things that strikes me about the music is that it is, it's extremely urbane, urban and urbane. I think that's one of the things that makes the Rhapsody so remarkable, is that sort of combination of elements.
Yeah, and you know, that's you know, thinking of those three people that you mentioned, Mozart and Gershwin and your brother, who all three of them were taken, you know, way before their time, you know, Mozart dying in his 30s as well, and Gershwin dying from, I believe it was lung cancer. But for correct,
Gershwin actually had a brain tumor.
Brain tumor.
Yeah, and he was in the hospital, you know, because he had headaches, and he he chose not to have a spinal tap actually, and that would have that would have made clear that he had a brain tumor. Although at that point, it's hard to know; it might have already been too late.
Yeah. Well, moving to another one of your characters, Marc Chagall, I think this story really encapsulates a lot of the points you're making in this book, in that Marc Chagall escaped from the Russian Revolution, World War I, and the Holocaust, and yet was still somehow able, in your words, to paint delight. So could you just talk about how Chagall was able to take all of this horror and still paint with such energy and life to his works?
It's really a remarkable phenomenon. I think he was probably sustained by his wife, Bella, in many ways. He has a wonderful, I would recommend this to anyone. It's called Ma Vie in French, or My Life. And the tonalities of his own writing seem to me it parallel in many ways the quality of tenderness and the sort of sensuous kind of the way that the palates are very sensuous in Chagall and full of sort of often softly bright colors, greens and pinks and blues. Mm-hmm. So it's a really hard question to answer. Like, how do such people not only carry on, but find these inner resources? When you learn about Russian history, and I'm sure that Grant, that probably are very familiar with this yourself. It's remarkable to me, that people are able to continue to put one foot in front of the other, but the life of its people, whether serfs in the 19th century or laborers in the 20th and 21st, maybe it's the shortness of that summer, that brilliant, brilliant short summer, because it's so much of the country is really intemperate. It's just such a glory, and perhaps that's what. Perhaps that's what Chagall was after, was the Russian summer. I think the other thing that I would say is that there is a way, and we know this from, for instance, James Joyce writing Ulysses, which is also in so many ways a very exuberant book, and one that is a kind of a book that seems very affirmative of Irish life, even in its difficulties. That it is often exiles, refugees, expatriates who create such tender portraits. So, you know, the distance is in a way produces that sense of effusion, I think, for the place that the person is not. So that is probably also, you know, Chagall went to Paris very early on because that was the center of the art world at his moment in time. That's where, you know, Picasso was in France too for a long, long period, since sort of the birth of modernism. So I think that that sense of moving from place to place and of choosing or of being forced to move in the end, for an artist, you know, one makes the most of that chasm. And in many ways, that's perhaps what Chagall was doing, was trying to get home in his work and choosing to see the parts of home that he wanted to see.
Yeah, that process of exile, which is obviously so prominent in the Jewish experience, and of nostalgia and distance and not taking those good things for granted, certainly provides some logical explanation to how these people were able to provide such accomplishment and achievement and verve and positive beauty in moments of such terror and depression.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and this is something I saw in my father. He would, the temperature was always, well, you know, there's always a sense of being in an area where there are a lot of storm fronts. So the barometer was wildly, you know, elevated or precipitously falling. But my father, when he, you know, he would be desolated for a moment, but only for a moment. And then he would pick himself up and have another idea. And I think that approach to defeat, to sort of say, well, this isn't really defeat. This is just a way of learning and of understanding that that this avenue isn't the best one for me to go down. So I think all the people I chose to write about were all, you know, similar in that generalized kind of way of approaching life, and that and I think also, you know, what to give in to despair is to, for them, was to not be able to work, and they wanted so to work. They had so many brilliant ideas, and so that was a release from the difficulties of the present. And I think that's something that that I really, you know, when I think about the book now and in the work I'm writing now, that I feel very strongly, that to remind ourselves, you know, that even in difficulty, that there are moments of beauty that we can create. I mean, you know, that said, obviously there are people that isn't true for people who are physically so debilitated and emotionally so distraught that they can't summon that energy. But as long as there is the possibility of maintaining some kind of energy, you know, there's the possibility of evading the difficulties in, you know, in front of us, at least for moments. And time's so relative anyway. You know, what do we choose to think about? Sometimes perhaps it's those, you know, as I mean, I can remember, even, and this probably seems very anecdotal, but you know, trips to Europe, and you know, what is it that I remember? Just moments, times of just of sometimes of quiet peace, or of taking a walk, not necessarily the moving around from monument to monument, but we really, the way we constellate our life's work has, you know, again, we curate that. So we can make decisions about that. And I think all of the people that I wrote about were really intentional in that way. And just had a great deal of a force of character and personality, and just sort of just worked through difficulty.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you speak so well and so eloquently on especially these people, these especially Jewish writers and authors and artists. But you also talk a bit about non-Jews and their role in this story. And Mozart, we talked about, but you also speak a lot about Dante and Dante's Inferno and some other people who are not Jewish. What role do these people play in your book?
So I think that's, I'm glad that you raised that. And, you know, I wrote about Jews because they're people I'm familiar with, from my own family. And, but, and that, and that, that, that the kind of my father's temperament I saw reflected in some of these other Jewish musicians and physicists and writers. But, you know, we, I think anyone who creates anything is always yoking unlike things together. And we live in a world where, especially now, where we can connect with people across borders. So I think, you know, for Jews in particular, who were almost always sort of considered a kind of a population with a host country. And I mean, this is really the place for this, but I mean, you know, it's fascinating to me to think about European nationalism and the ways in which it was soldered or sustained or driven in part by distinguishing the Jewish populations in the midst of these nations. You know, that became one way for so many countries to distinguish themselves as countries to move from the position of, you know, the sort of city states to federations and imagine community. I mean, you know, imagine community, you have to imagine someone outside of it in order, it seems, in order to create community, which is a great shame. And I think that's what I wanted to do with the Dante and Primo Levi piece, was to think about how remarkable it was that somebody who had been in, who had survived Auschwitz should locate himself in Auschwitz itself, recalling not a Jewish chemist or a scientist, but a fellow writer, and Dante, who is a compatriot across many centuries. And that is just extraordinarily striking to me. And the sense of camaraderie, I mean, it's by what Levi suggests in the Auschwitz memoir, is that it is by reciting lines from thinking about Homer and thinking about Dante and Homer's Odysseus's sort of voyage that Dante picks up on, was what allowed him to remember that he was a person, even while, you know, being so undernourished and so so physically abject, that the words of somebody, a Christian who was creating a Christian series of worlds in the Paradiso and the Purgatorio and the Inferno, and that seemed to me such an extraordinary gesture of largesse that someone who could be a victim of the Holocaust would do that. I just was so struck by that.
Yeah. The last line of Dante's Inferno has stuck with me for a while, and I recalled it when I was reading your piece, and roughly it translates, you know, it's at the very end when Dante and his guide Virgil have ascended out of the final circle of hell and are coming back to the world. And it goes, "Thence we came forth to see again the stars," and this sort of journey from hell back to beholding wonder in the world and majesty and beauty, I think spoke a lot to your piece and to Primo Levi's journey as well, too, that you talk of.
Thank you. That's such a gracious and eloquent way of capping that part of our discussion. I really appreciate that, Grant.
Of course, of course. So at the end of the book, you have this fantastic call to listen. And you note how that now that you're older, you can hear the grins as well as the sighs in Grace Paley's work. Can you speak a little bit of that final call to listen? And is struggle and experience in your mind essential for helping us sort of sit down and listen better?
So that's a wonderful question. When I first read Grace Paley, I was probably in my 20s, and I just sort of cocked my head. You know how dogs cock their heads when you speak to them in intonations they don't understand? And I really could not get my mind around her. I didn't understand how to read her characters. They were so mixed. They seemed so flawed. They seemed not very romantic. And then I heard her read when I was in my early 30s. The inflections that she brought, there was a kind of question at the end of almost every phrase that she read that turned even harsh sentiments into possibilities. And that really struck me. And it was really in listening to her voice that made me, that allowed me to see the nuances in her fiction. I think as academics, we tend, I think about going to talks and the strange protocol of going to talks. And, you know, people often nod, but also at the same time, they're sort of building up arguments against the speaker. And I'm guilty of that as well. I think, to really to let the person have their due rather than to rush to judge is crucial. And I think that so much of political life, on any side is about performance, again, is about carrying banners, is about, sort of in loud voices offering slogans. That's not really about listening. That's about speaking. And when we read, we have to listen. We have to hear other voices, which is, I think, one of the wonderful things about reading. And that's the same for looking at any art. We have to open up and just let things wash over us. And I think that's, it may not be, it may not seem like a metropolitan or an urbane way of being to sort of act with that level of mystery and curiosity, but I think it's absolutely crucial. And I try to tell, I try to tell myself that to always try to listen. It's definitely a work in progress and one that I've really just begun embarking upon, but there's so much you can, in the tonalities of someone's voice, that if you really get that, rather than the words they're saying, like what is the tone in which they're speaking? Is there a way to listen to that?
That's a great, great lesson. And besides that call to listen, and you mentioned a bit at the beginning, but as sort of the final substantive question here, in this moment of this new year of 2021, in a year, of a past year that has been somewhat hopeful, but also terrifying in a lot of different ways. What do you hope that your readers will take away from this book in this moment? And any messages of hope or warning and instruction that you particularly want them to get from your work?
I hope that that they will remember to never give up. I mean, of course, there is a point in everyone's life when they're nearing the end of their life, whenever that is, when they make a decision, often a conscious decision to stop working, to stop breathing. I mean, that can really happen for people. The fact that more people die, in the early hours of the morning before dawn than any other time is interesting, because that's a difficult time for most of us, except my daughter who stays up very late. But I think to not ever stop asking questions, to not give up, to not assume that even when the road looks full of obstacles, that there is no getting around them. To think about the value of seeing from the fringes and from another person's point of view, and to think about the ways that perhaps venturing out of one's own field or one's own comfort zone can often produce really striking ways of thinking and be a positive force for all of us. It's always a learning experience. I think those are things that I would want that I might want people to take. And then finally, I think to sort of honor people who, you know, traveled from one country to another. And that is really the, you know, like it or not, I mean, that is still the story of this country and really of the world. We are a burgeoning population globally, which is clearly why, you know, there is so much fear. And we, you know, what it takes for people to cross national borders is tremendous. And to try to, you know, open our hearts to people and to try to do the same in our own imaginations, even if we are not stepping foot outside of our door, I think is crucial to be fearless in that way.
Definitely. Well, I really hope and trust that your readers will understand that and give them hope for the future. So the final question that we like to ask all our guests here at the New York Next Works is, if you could describe any new projects or works or essays that you have on the horizon for you.
So I'm working on a collection of essays, which actually is, I hope, close to complete. And it is about the elements. There's a quartet of pieces on the classical elements. There's a piece on water that focuses on deep sea jellyfish, a piece on earth that focuses on rock, a piece on air that is an ode to energy, which is about wind, and a piece on fire that I've just finished. It's different in that I'm looking at again trying to change my own perspective, but this time what so many people are doing is thinking about the larger world and perhaps resizing the human. And then, you know, I think about the work of some Indian painters in like the 15th, 16th through 19th centuries, these beautiful, small, brilliant paintings in which you see sort of a glimpse of the entire world. And people aren't really always foregrounded. I mean, plants can be as big. And that's really what I'm working on in this next collection is thinking about the world around us. What do plants know? What do they do? How do they behave? What is life like for insects? Mm-hmm. It's a very different collection, but and I'm entitling it for now an aria for insects and other essays. But that's what I've embarked upon for the moment. Yeah.
That's great. Well, I hope to see that collection very soon in print.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for this wonderful discussion and engaging book, which I think is much needed at this time. And it's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Dr. Gold.
It has been an honor. Thank you so much, Grant.
Of course. Stargazing in the Atomic Age is out now by University of Georgia Press. This is R. Grant Kleiser saying thank you very much, and see you next time on the New Books Network.